doing in this lesson a follow-up lesson to two previous lessons. This lesson on resilience, what it is and how we develop it in our lives, is following up on, first, the lesson that we did during last Advent that stretched a little bit into the new year, where when we spoke about our tradition's call to and the practices that the tradition gives us that enable us to champion hope during the dark times. The tools that we explored during that lesson are foundational to resilience because hope in the midst of dark times, that's a pretty critical component for the resilient soul and the resilient life. The second lesson that we're following up on is the one we just finished, restitching the torn fabric of community, because also critical to the resilient life is authentic spiritual community. As the wetlands are to migratory birds, we said, so authentic community is to us. It is the environment in which we thrive. It is the environment without which we suffer. So we in RCC, as many other spiritual communities, we are creating the safe spaces to do this, the environment together. It's creating these spaces where we can encourage one another to be our most authentic selves, even when the best authentic self we can access on a given day would be our false self, our tripping ourselves up selves. We're stitching together the environment for belonging, even when our weaknesses show, warts and all, we say. If we're doing this, we're stitching together an environment in which we can belong on our good days when we're able to put our best foot forward, but also on our worst days when we're stuck in a reactive behavior mode. It's the environment for practicing oneness that is not sameness. In other words, we can be different and yet belong, trusting and being trusted, loving and being loved, sharing the spiritual journey together when it exposes our shadow sides and when it calls forth the brightness of our truer selves. Because, we discussed, authentic community is not just a tool for building resilience. It's the habitat for which we're designed. So consequently, when we live in that environment, it is the fountainhead of our health, of our strength, and it is the fountainhead of resilience. So again, this lesson is a follow-up on those two. I began last week talking about resilience by telling a story from Paul's life. It was a backstory that helped us understand something that he wrote about resilience. This is what he wrote. He said, "I know what it is to be in need. I know what it is to have plenty. I know what it is to suffer. I know what it is to have great joy. I've had it all. And along the way, I've learned to access internal settledness no matter where I am. I've learned to access the internal source of strength to make it through anything." If you missed the story behind that text, have a listen online. But after we heard Paul tell us that this kind of interior resilience is ours to have, then James, another author of our ancient text, told us yet another way that we go about accessing it. He said this. He said, our troubles are another way that we develop resilience. Now, struggle just makes us stronger. That's kind of a truism. When we survive a stress, when we survive something difficult, wired into our bodies and wired into our brains are mechanisms that repair and heal and re-strengthen us. But with those things also comes the capacity to build back even stronger than it was before, so that should we be stressed again, we would be prepared for it. That's wired right into our bodies, wired right into our brains. But James tells us that on the spiritual journey, there's even more to the process than that. More than that natural mechanism. Troubles and struggles help us go deeper on our spiritual journeys, awaken us to a deeply spiritual way to develop resilience. Listen to the text that we read last week. Listen to it again. "My friends, when challenges come into your life and tests and troubles, even beset from all sides kinds of struggles, it'll help you if you see these tough times as precious gifts." I know that's an odd idea, but think about it this way. Under the pressure of pain and struggle, your two true colors show. You see them. You see your weaknesses and your frailties and your blind spots. This is the gift part. It forces you to dig deeply to access an even deeper part of you, the indwelling Spirit of God. Struggles awaken you to the deeper life. They mature you, develop you, awaken you. So pain and struggles and troubles and disappointment, these do for us what good times don't do. What they do is they surface false self-strategies in our lives, false self-strategies in our souls, strategies that remain quietly working in the background when times are good, when sailing is smooth. They don't get poked during those easy times. Well, I want to expand this week on that part of what I said last week. I want to do it by revisiting something that we talked about extensively together early on in the life of our community. Early on in the life of our community, you've heard us talk about the hard work that we have been doing, rethinking what it means to be Christian, rethinking the story that we tell ourselves that we would call the Christian narrative. Now, the reason for that work is something you hear me say all the time. As with any human endeavor, it is our tradition's way. It's true of the Christian tradition that it is our way to lose our way. Usually recounted at this point would be something like the Crusades or resisting civil rights or some such thing that we've done along the way. It is our way to lose our way. But a tradition is a tradition because it has been around for a long time. And a tradition wouldn't be around for a long time if it didn't have another component also embedded right in it. So it is not just our way to lose our way, it is also our way to find our way once we've lost it. Yes, it is our way to lose our way, but it is also our way to find our way when we have. Now, it's painfully evident that we Christians have lost our way these last few generations. It's less evident that we're also finding our way again. You have to be looking to see where that is happening. And our community has decided to go all in on this Finding Our Way Again project. Now, how we have approached it is to begin to take these things that we realize are toxic, and there's been a whole basket of them, and strip them down past all the incrustations and all the barnacles that have kind of accumulated around these ideas to find the core good that was there when this practice or when this belief began. And then as we find out this essential good, to then begin to rebuild something that would work in our context, in our society, in our worldview on the basis of that, and to restore a belief or a practice. That's been how we've been doing this process. Now, you can read about what I'm going to talk about today in the book. If you haven't got the book, if you haven't heard about the book, we wrote a book about all this work that we did for all this time. And so one of the critical parts of the Christian story that has been in desperate need of rethinking in our lifetime and in the generations before ours is how we Christians tell our story about sin. And that's the part I want to talk about today as it bears on resilience. We usually tell our sin story something like this. You've done a bad thing, nasty thing, done a bunch of them. And so that's where the focus of our story goes. And once our story has focused on the bad thing, the nasty thing, then there's usually, following up on the second part of the story, something about guilt and shame because of the nasty thing that you did. Shame on you. You've done this nasty thing. You're bad. Shame on you. Then there's usually something in the story about cringing under God's judgment because we've done the bad thing, because God is holy and holiness cannot abide to be in the presence of unholiness. So consequently, we are now facing separation from God or judgment at the hand of God or some such thing. Until, the story continues, we pray the prayer. And then once we pray the prayer, then we escape God's judgment. Now, hidden underneath the story that we tell are some unconscious overtones that go all the way back to the 5th century, probably even before that, to a phrase that was coined by one of our more well-known theologians, and that term is original sin. And what original sin means is that way back when the human race was just starting, our original parents, Adam and Eve, they sinned. And when they did, they fundamentally changed the nature of being human. entering into the human race at that point was no longer the breath of God, the indwelling Spirit of God as the defining essence of who we are, but now has entered this ugly, ugly sinfulness. And every child born of that union is genetically, is fundamentally changed in nature, and that is all of us. Instead of our most basic essence being the breath of God, which, by the way, is the first story that our book tells us. The very first story that it tells is that you and I are made out of earth and breath. We're made out of the elements of this earth and the breath of the divine. And we were inert, until that breath is given to us. And when that breath goes away, we are no longer human. So the breath of God, by the way, in both Hebrew and in Greek, in all of our ancient texts, the word breath and the word spirit are the same word. So you and I are made alive. We are animated by the very Spirit of God. That is the defining essence of our being. And when that Spirit leaves, we stop being. So you cannot not be animated by, filled with the Spirit of God. But that's how the story started. But around the second or third or fourth century, we changed our story and said, instead, now, once you are born, you are born infected. You are born carrying the virus of sin. It is the defining essence of who you are, and it is ugly. Ugly, ugly sinfulness. That defines your deepest and truest self. Which puts every child that's born, every human being that walks the earth, into kind of a pickle. Because now, with this fundamental essence with which we are born, we deserve nothing but punishment. We deserve nothing but death. We deserve nothing but separation from God. Unless we pray the prayer that gets us off the hook. Well, you can read more about this in the book, but there are a lot of toxic connotations that come with that story. There are a lot of harmful things that happen when that is the story that we tell ourselves about ourselves, and that is the Torah story that we tell ourselves about the nature of God. And it turns out that that's not the only way that we Christians have told the story of our natures. It's not the only way that we've told the story of sin. We've told that story that way because initially it kind of started when Rome co-opted the Christian church way back in 325, 327, something like that. Kind of took a little bit more, got a little more traction somewhere around 1500. But then in 1860, 1880, 1890, Darwin came along and scared the pants off the church because, oh my Lord, this stuff that he's saying, it's freaking us out. At the same time, biblical criticism was coming as a science, and we were looking at the Bible as a document as opposed to a holy book, and that scared our socks off. And when we were scared, we entrenched, and we said, you got to hold on to the core fundamentals of the faith, or we're going to stop being Christian. And when we did that, we started telling the story the way that I just told it exclusively. And it had never been our exclusive way to tell our story, but that's when it became, under the pressure of a perceived threat. That's how we started telling the story of sin. So, these years earlier in our community, when we were rethinking this Christian story, we began to look back into history at different ways that Christians have talked about sin, different ways that we have talked about human nature, and it helped us begin to reimagine our narrative. And we hit upon a metaphor that we found very helpful. It was the metaphor of a wound rather than a core essence. In other words, there is a wound that we all carry, a universal wound. It doesn't define our very essence with this ugliness of sin right at the core of who we are, but it is a wound, we imagine, that stems from a persistent illusion that we all carry. And this is the illusion that you are not a carrier of the very breath of God. The illusion is that you are not a carrier of the very Spirit of God. The illusion is that you are not consequently precious, and you are not consequently valuable. Because if we are not carriers of God's very Spirit, then we are just dirt. and consequently we are not of immeasurable worth. And we are not swimming in a reality of goodness and safety, and God is not good, and we are not safe. But this persistent illusion that we carry continues and says, since that's the case, since you are not, since I am not defined by our divine breath center, and thus, since we are not of infinite worth, and thus, since we are not of infinite preciousness, then we must, all of us, go out and earn our worth. We must go out and earn our preciousness. We must prove it, show it. So, that's a challenge. How do we go about doing that? So, you and I, we're all each born with certain aptitudes. Maybe you are good with people, or maybe you're good at focusing energy on a task, or maybe you're good at organizing, or maybe you're good at compassion or empathy or kindness. And under pressure of our universal illusion that we are not defined by the very breath of God at our center, that we are not carriers of infinite worth and preciousness, what we do is we tend to grab whatever is at hand to mitigate the consequences of that illusion. And what we usually pick up is what's at hand, what we're naturally good at. We pick up a tool that helps us ward off the pain that comes with our universal wound. If, as our illusion tells us, we are not precious or valuable or good or safe, if, as our illusion tells us, we must earn our worth or prove our value, then here is something that I'm good at. This is something that makes me good. This is something that makes me valuable. And that is how I'm going to earn my worth, and that is how I'm going to prove my preciousness. And so, for some, we pick up a strategy of amassing a bucket of cash so that we can prove to ourselves and we can prove to others that we are successful. Or we might still amass a bucket of cash, but not to prove that we're successful, but just to make ourselves feel safe, because it's a dangerous world out there. And that bucket of cash will help me feel secure or safe. We might conversely amass a whole bunch of people who like us. We do that by being super nice or super serving or super understanding. And we employ these homespun strategies in order to prove to ourselves and to prove to others that we are good, that we are valuable, that we are precious, and to mitigate the debilitating pain that comes from that illusion. And that, as we were imagining how we would rethink our sin story, that whole process and that whole construct, that could be worthy of the word sin. The deep illusion that I am not a carrier of the breath of God, the deep illusion that I am not of infinite worth and value, and the subsequent compensating strategies that drive me having to earn my worth and to prove my value. So this internal cluster of motivations and strategies, this works for us. And it actually works for quite a long time, because you are good at stuff. I am good at stuff. You're good at different stuff than I am, but we're all good at something. And so this way of going about life, managing the pain of our universal wound, it works for us when we get the job or when we keep the job. But it works less well when we don't get the job or we get laid off. It works for us when we make the deal or when we fulfill the deadline. It doesn't work for us as much when we don't. It works for us when we are able to amass a bucket of cash, and we do feel safe, or we do feel valuable, or we do feel successful, we feel good. It works for us when we do have time to serve in a nonprofit or some such thing, to be with people and exercise our kindness and goodness. It especially works for us when people respond well to our efforts and appreciate us. Then our strategy works. We get to tell ourselves the story that we are noble, and we get to tell ourselves the story that we are good, we are safe, and we are powerful. So when things go well, our strategies for dealing with our universal wound work for us. And because they're working for us, they can remain intact for long periods of time as they go unchallenged in a world that works for us. They can remain intact. The only problem with that whole system is that life will never arrange itself so that things go well for us all the time. And now we start to get close to our need for resilience. These stitched together strategies that draw from whatever we were born to be good at, they are not true enough truths. They don't work in this world as this world really is. Because what we do is this cluster of processes and motivations and beliefs that we've kind of created that we call the false self, what we do is we begin to define them as me. This is what I do. This is what I am. And these truths are not big enough to define that word self. They are not big enough to contain that construct that we call me. Despite our valiant efforts to prop these strategies up, to build and rebuild them, and to shore them when they begin to suffer, and to protect them, these strategies are not the truest truths, and they are not the realest real, and so they will always and inevitably break down on us. And when they do, we suffer a bout of unresilience. When they do, and we lack the preparation required for any alternative strategies, we are left vulnerable to that universal wound coming roaring back in. See, you're not precious. See, you're not good. See, you're not of infinite worth. But when the wound comes roaring back, it usually doesn't come with those direct words. It usually comes through the side door. More likely, the words would be stupid or lazy or failure or wasted potential or stagnating, failed at love, bad mother, that's a common one, bad husband. Just as likely as that, the words that we will hear in our heads when this wound comes roaring back would blame someone else. They are the stupid one or the lazy or the failure or the wasted one. And that's a process. And it's a process that happens to all of us. A universal process. But as we've seen in so many dynamics on the spiritual journey, all that stuff, it happens way, way below the level of conscious awareness. Most of that happens down there where we don't pay any attention. What happens consciously in our awareness is hearing those words. That's what we become aware of. Some iteration of those words. I hate myself or I hate that person. I'm bad at this or I'm too good for it. Some such iteration of those words. That's what we become consciously aware of. And we become completely unaware of what's going on that's driving the process. It comes out as worry, or it comes out as fear. It comes out as hatred, or it comes out as revenge. We judge others. We outgroup. We create pecking orders. We do avoidance of things that we don't want to have to deal with. What happens consciously is a bunch of bad thought processes and a bunch of negative behaviors. Things that in our old way of telling the story, we would have called sins. Bad things that we do. But now, hopefully, we look at this and we say, the bad things that we do are really just the tip of the iceberg. And they're kind of not the point. Because if you're going to run afoul of this thing, you're not going to hit the tip. You're going to hit this big, massive thing that's going on underneath. That's what's going to sink the ship. So it's no point to just pay attention to observing the tip of the iceberg. You've got to look at the whole submerged thing in order to be able to process this and process it well. But when we reduce our idea of sin to just what's at the tip, just those bad behaviors that are a result of this engine that's driving them underneath, then we not only reduce our story of sin, but we reduce the whole approach that we take to overcoming sin. Some list of bad things will never do. If we fail to look under the surface of those behaviors to see the driving dynamic and to see our universal wound and our false self strategies and our reactionary responses, we will have reduced our story of sin and reduced our options that are available to begin to challenge it in our lives. Because what we tend to do is settle for minimalist strategies. When that's our story of sin, the way that we handle it is we beat ourselves up. hoping that if we beat ourselves hard enough, that will motivate us to do better next time. That just doesn't work. Or we shame ourselves, or we hate ourselves. But that often happens unconsciously because we can't abide the idea that we would be shaming ourselves. And so often that's just, we're keeping our heads above water from that. Or we white knuckle it. We swear before God and everything that's holy that this time, the last 40 times, yeah, I slipped and fell, but this time, I'm not. I'm going to get it this time, and we hold on and we fight it. And the thing is, that works for a little while, but it's not a very good long-term strategy. It doesn't work for long. If you grew up in church, maybe your strategy was to fess up, tell the priest, or to tell a friend and soak ourselves with guilt and contrition. And the truth is that there is some merit to getting that stuff out and talking about it as opposed to keeping it all bottled up inside. But without a comprehensive strategy that unearths the false self-strategies that have been driving this in the first place, fessing up and being contrite, that doesn't do much for very long either. So, rethinking our sin story, getting a more comprehensive understanding of the whole dynamic so that we are better prepared to deal with what is. So now back to resilience. How does that rethinking of our sin story have anything to do with how we develop resilience? Well, it's like this. Resilience is strength under pressure. Resilience is bouncing back when we have taken a hit. Resilience is the capacity to keep going even when we suffer tragic events, even when we are facing devastating losses. Resilience, our author told us last week, is that interior resource that enables us to have troubles but not be overrun, be perplexed but not despair, persecuted but not forsaken, cast down but not destroyed. At the core of that capacity is this whole dynamic around our universal wound. Foundational to resilience is building an internal world that is not as dependent upon strategies that won't work. In other words, when our inner worlds depend unconsideredly on false self-strategies, and when our daily equilibrium counts on those strategies to keep things going well, things will go along well as long as things go along well. But that is not what resilience is. As soon as waters are troubled, as soon as pain rains down upon us, as soon as troubles wash over us, our false self strategies, being by their very nature false, prove to be insufficient. They are not true enough or real enough or robust enough to give us an interior equilibrium that Paul described when things are not going well. And so when we are talking about the spiritual journey, when we talk about working the circle, when the announcements invite you to participate in one of these four iterations of practice, ancient spiritual practice, when you're invited to do some things that are forming authentic spiritual community, or doing some things that will develop your contemplative practice, or when we're learning, or when we're serving, when we are walking this journey together and keeping encouraging one another to move forward and be steadfast in our practices, what we're doing is we're helping one another do the work that will help us see. Help us see our false self strategies. We're helping one another do the work that will help us rise above, dissociate from our false self strategies. What we're helping one another do is be steadfast in the practices, in the work that's going to help us move beyond these false self versions of me or self and move into the deeper reality of the indwelling Spirit of God that is at the center of our being, our authentic selves, our divine breath selves, our Spirit of God selves. So, James tells us, it's a gift when our troubles force us out of our blindness. It's a gift when our troubles expose to us our false self strategies. It's a gift when our troubles bring into conscious awareness how limiting those strategies are. It's a gift when our troubles compel us to dig deeply to find divine center awareness and seeing our false self strategies. That's where the process begins. It's one of the reasons that we study the Enneagram together, that personality grid by which we look at our personalities in a way that helps us anticipate what false self strategies might have taken up residence in our souls. Because we're all kind of clustered together in certain patterns, and I can learn from your pattern if you have a personality similar to me, and so I might have a leg up, a roadmap to what false self strategies I might be depending upon. It helps us to understand that all of those strategies tend to cluster into three groups: the strategies that distract us from our weaknesses, the strategies that distract us from our feelings of insecurity, and the strategies that distract us from our feelings of unpreciousness. We call it power and control, safety and security, affirmation and worth. Our different personalities tend to gravitate toward different strategies. But no matter which one we settle on, they will always be inadequate. As long as we don't see them, as long as we don't see them to be able to challenge them, we're not going to be able to transcend them. We will always be vulnerable, and we will always be unresilient. False self strategies are the source of non-resilience. As long as we depend upon them to navigate our daily life, we will always be vulnerable because they will never be big enough or strong enough or true enough. So James teaches us, troubles are a gift. Suffering is a gift, not because we like them. Nobody likes them. But because they bring to the surface what's been going on down there all along, what has been plaguing our lives, whether we are aware or unaware. Good times don't do that for us. Easy times, pleasant times, what they do is they allow those false self strategies to remain intact. Troubled times unearth them. Troubled times bring them up from tacit to explicit awareness. So, if we were to take all of that background and go back and try and bring some of the older religious language, older Christian language to bear upon it, it might go like this. If we tell the story of sin through this lens of the false self and the universal wound, then we could imagine trials and tribulations as part of our story. Here it comes, religious speak, you ready? This might be part of our story of salvation. Now, if you grew up in church, that might be a little bit puzzling, because salvation means when you pray the prayer so that you don't have to face the consequences that God would impose upon you for your sin in the afterlife. But that kind of doesn't make sense, because one of the things that Paul teaches us, he says you're going to be working out your salvation over the whole course of your whole life. But the way that we've told the story in these last couple of generations, or the last few generations, especially since 1898, has been to say salvation happens when you go down in front of the church and you get on your knees and you pray the prayer. When you pray the prayer and you invite the free gift of God, which is the eternal life, then at that point, salvation. You're done. You're finished. Now you're just really just waiting until you go to heaven, because that prayer will get you into heaven. Which makes no sense when Paul says work out your salvation over the course of a lifetime. How do you do that if that's what salvation is, that day when you prayed that prayer? But what we're saying is that's not what salvation is. Salvation is what our Hebrew worldview insisted. When you are stuck and you are trapped and you find your way out, that is salvation. When you're laboring under a heavy load and you can't see your way forward and then you find your way forward, that is salvation. We experience it any time we awaken to the deeper realities of the divine. Awareness saves us from unawareness. Salvation from our dependence upon faulty instincts. Salvation from instincts that condemn us to non-resilience. Salvation from instincts that keep us perpetually inadequately prepared for life as life really is. So the invitation of today's lesson, last week's lesson, and going to be next week's lesson, if we were to put it into language familiar in the religious tradition, this lesson is an invitation to salvation. ongoing salvation, every day, year on year, decade on decade, working out our freedom from the illusion and compensatory strategies that bind us. The invitation of this lesson is to honor the ancient wisdom that James affords us, that our pain and our suffering can be a powerful gift, a gift no less than the gift of salvation, no less than freedom from the ties that bind us, from the prisons that hold us. If our troubles can help us see the inadequacy of our false self strategies, then our troubles can invite us to see what those false self strategies are. And once we can see what they are and dig into them more deeply, we can discover that there is a truth on the other side of those inadequate truths. There is a reality on the other side of those inadequate realities. There is a deeper version of self. There is a deeper source, a version of self that is rooted in the indwelling Spirit of God that each of us carry because we carry breath. And I pray that would be our experience. And just on a practical note, did you hear Brandon's announcement? Because that's kind of one of the tools that we use to get from here to there. So Lord, may it be so that we experience the full complement of what is ours in our tradition, salvation. Be that so in us, and then may it flow through us one to another. Amen.